Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for your listening discomfort and displeasure, because let's face it, if you're tuning into the truth and you want to be comforted, you've come to the wrong place. The truth is not a very comforting thing. It often, in fact, will mean that you have to let go of certain things, you know, beliefs that you held long ago, concepts of what you think you are. Those are the kind of things the truth really likes to mess with, because the easiest person, contrary to popular belief, to lie to is in fact yourself. You know why? Because you don't see it coming. You go, oh, I wouldn't lie to me. But you do. You do. So now, ladies and gentlemen, allow me to introduce our very special guest. I think it's Dr. Daryl Hamamoto. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eastwood. Glad to be here.
Nobody's called me the Mr. Eastwood since I got arrested in my late teens.
Okay. Well, may I address you as Vinny?
Go for your life. Everybody does.
Is that better? Okay.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is for you to do.
Well, I've been at the University of California at the Davis branch for about 20 years, and I'm in the Ethnic Studies Department, and I've had a pretty rocky career for an academic, and most recently, I guess it started happening about 3 years ago, I ran into a particularly rough patch, and I tried to figure out what was going on, and I came to realize that the problems that I was experiencing coincided with the appearance of one Janet Napolitano, who was formerly of the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, who immortalized the phrase, see one, catch one. Is that what it was?
It was
something
if you
of that
see,
sort.
If you see something, say something.
Or... Yes, right. So that's we know her as Big Sister.
And, see, where I come from, Napolitano is a kind of ice cream.
Oh, it is. Neapolitan ice cream. It's pink, vanilla, and chocolate. Is that what it is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're getting fascism in all flavors to the University of California.
Now, maybe that's the whole point of a false dichotomy, right, is to give you two really bad choices.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they give us a rainbow of choices, literally. So, and this is one of the sources of confusion. People don't know which color to identify with.
I find
red,
it's assume
blue,
the worst.
So what's happened is that the types of lectures that used to make me one of the more popular professors on campus, with students numbering in a couple of hundreds in one class, it completely turned around. It's a 180. And this also coincided with what we've seen across America, and to a certain extent in Britain, with the rise of the social justice warriors, right? These are the people who are foundation creations, such as the George Soros Open Society. And what's happened is that the universities have empowered these students to go after dissident professors like myself. And I say dissident with a touch of irony, because I'm not a dissident. I'm a very, I would think, mainstream academic type person who has fallen out of sync with the political orthodoxy. And the political orthodoxy has devolved into something that's that we know generically as political correctness. And that is that you have to be very, very careful, very vigilant, as to what you say in the classroom or even outside the classroom, because the students have been primed to take umbrage, to take offense, to take grievous insults at any of your comments, your remarks, or observations, no matter how seemingly benign they might be. They'll come right after you. So this is what's been happening for the past 3 years.
Let me get this straight. maybe something familiar for you is that you'll have someone coming up at you and accuse you of thinking something that you never said.
Absolutely. I'm guilty of a thought crime. This is something I thought was just in these dystopian novels like 1984 or Brave New World. But they've been implemented in the year 2016. And it's been growing over the past several years, but it really reached a zenith this fall when you had these undergraduates, these snot-nosed, poo-butt undergraduates at Yale University, one of the most entitled, to use one of their terms, privileged institutions of higher learning in the world, trying to sweat professors because they said, hey, lighten up on the whole Halloween costuming bit. It's not a big deal. I think that was the YouTube video that went around the world, correct? Whoa. And then you had Professor Melissa Click at the University of Missouri, who assaulted, at least verbally, two student journalists for coming into their quote-unquote safe space while they were engaged in some sort of demonstration against a Phantom Menace. Another very popular YouTube video. And you know what? The American public, the world public is wondering what's going on at the university. What happened? What was the genesis of this? What's behind it? What are the forces behind it? And I'm here today with you, Vinny, Mr. Eastwood, to help explain it to your audience.
Well, there was a great comedian called Steve Hughes, he said political correctness is just intellectual colonialism and psychological fascism for the creation of thought crime.
I'll go along with that definition. It's perfect.
In the future, your very words could have consequences on your very being, your body, right? And I learned this in high school, and I think a lot of people did. You know, if you say the wrong thing to the wrong kind of authoritarian, fascist jackboot person or whatever, you know, you get reprimanded, you get punished. But people don't realize that once you leave school, or it doesn't matter what institution you go to, it doesn't matter whether you get a job, there will always be those kind of people bossing you around, telling you what to say, what to think. And I think the whole concept of punishing people for what they say will eventually lead to people not being able to think for themselves either.
And really, that is the object, to deprive people of their creativity and their own thoughts by making sure that they're so intimidated, so frightened, that they would not dare utter anything that would be even mildly offensive to someone else. And that's the ultimate form of political control, short of executing 60 million people, let's say. Just silence them in that fashion. Now, I went into this profession with the idealistic, romantic expectation that, hey, in academia, I'll have free reign, at least much more free reign than most people in other types of jobs or professions, right? Free inquiry, intellectual freedom. That's the foundation of, at least in the West, the university, the educational system. And I've been proven wrong. Not that I'm going to submit to it, but the administration right now with Janet Napolitano, big sister at the top, including Linda Katehi, who a few years ago gassed a peaceful assembly of mostly students because of their public assembly, their demonstration against tuition hikes and other degrading aspects of the University of California operations. She gassed them. She's still there. And more recently, she was outed for having taken paying positions as on a board of directors of a proprietary school. So she was feathering her nest up and down. In addition to that, she has her husband teaching in one of the science departments, making a fairly good salary with a master's degree. You know, he might be a decent individual. I don't know. But anyway, this is what's being focused on over the past couple of weeks. But my analysis goes much deeper than that. In fact, I even suspect that this brouhaha concerning her double dipping might even be a diversion, because there's much deeper structural corruption that pervades the University of California and probably all the universities, public and private, in the U.S. They're mostly, to put it very simply, they're mostly a financial front, an engine for Wall Street.
That's very interesting you should say that, because our Prime Minister, John Key, he came out from, I think it was Harvard University. He went to Harvard Business School as part of his thing before going into Merrill Lynch and and then ending up with a hell of a lot of Bank America shares, and then comes to New Zealand, becomes the Prime Minister, and then in his first term he borrows more money than all previous Prime Ministers in the country combined.
Your Prime Minister fits the profile. Mm. It's either Harvard School of Business or the University of Chicago. The University of Chicago train any number of prime ministers, presidents, and high-level government officials and send them down to Latin America. And look at the wreck it is, right? So this is part of the pattern. They come to America and they situate them in these specialized graduate programs, then send them back to their home country to rule in a form of neocolonial intellectual thievery. So this money is being siphoned out of New Zealanders' pockets and sent overseas to the City of London and Wall Street, mostly the City of London, though, because as you know very well now, and your viewers know this as well, this is the financial center of the world.
That's right. And John Key did work on Wall Street for 2 years as Merrill Lynch's representative on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And he was also in charge of the European bond and derivatives trade in the 2000 days, you know, just after Glass-Steagall got repealed. And derivatives were currently, you know, all of a sudden legal, because they managed to also block the New York State Gaming Commission's claim that it was gambling, and they tried to get muscle in on the action and said, no, you don't need any of this action, bro. It's going to be a $2 quadrillion bubble. That's nothing to worry about.
This is high-level racketeering, right? They make these movies about organized crime, sicario, drug lords, and street crimes and all that. As bad as it is, it's nothing compared to Wall Street. Nothing. And these criminals need to be brought to justice. First of all, we have to identify the framework in which they're operating, and you summarized quite nicely their biographies, their trajectories, their career trajectories, where they come from and where they wind up. And so we have to get to the second part, is that how do we restore democratic processes, judicial processes, so these people can be punished to the full extent of the law, so that we, the ordinary people, the little people, can go about our lives in freedom and relative happiness, and with the ability to provide for ourselves and our families. We don't ask for much. At least I don't. I don't need to be super wealthy like some of these high-level state criminals.
Yeah, it's also a psychological slash, I don't know, sometimes it borderlines on the spiritual, you know. It's like you're dealing with a human possessed by something, right? And for me, the something that they're possessed by is corporate psychopathology, right? Now, what it means is that they're charming and enchanting when you first meet them, but they're pretty shallow, have very few meaningful, long-lasting relationships, and they really only crave money, power, and sex, but they're willing to sabotage, intimidate, manipulate, steal, defame, lie, and cheat shamelessly without guilt of any kind. They don't feel any guilt, and they need attention and idolization. They want to be seen as great, and they've got pathological narcissism as well, which means they've got no sense of humor about when you're criticizing them. And they're often not really able to keep it in their pants either. They're pretty sexually promiscuous. And when you think about that, when somebody first read that description to me, I was like, oh my God, it's like every employer I've ever had, bro.
Absolutely. Now, Professor Robert Hare broke that down. He talks about ordinary or corporate psychopathology. And it's all these individuals that fit that profile that you just explained that rise to the top of these little hierarchies, these little pyramids, because the bulk of humanity is not interested in these little sadomasochistic head trips that these people delight in engaging with. They take a sadistic pleasure in getting over on us and cheating us and scamming us. The only time they're happy, the only time a smile comes to their face is when they think they're getting over on their mark. And this is the classic confidence man, the con man, correct? Herman Melville. It's not just an American trait, although we have an overabundance of them.
What was it the Red Skull said in Captain America?
He wrote a novel called The Confidence Man, right? He knew this in the mid-19th century where we were heading. And now we are at the zenith of what the great novelist Herman Melville was seeing in our future. And they have the full back of the police and the military and the judicial system to support their psychopathology. And that's where it gets dangerous, because they can throw you in prison. They can persecute, they can target you, just like they've targeted me at the University of California, and they can put you out. You can die of a heart attack, right? Your business can be ruined. You can be thrown out of a career. You name it. The many examples of people who have come up against these people. You know, maybe Prince was one of such individuals. By the way, before we go on, Vinny, what's your take on the recent death of Prince, Rogers Nelson?
I actually haven't really looked into it at all. You know, I just heard about his death and that's it.
All right. Okay.
But if you've got something to say about it, I'm very, very interested.
Yeah, I'm speculating on this. By the way, if you want to read a more full account of this, you can look at your viewers can look at my Facebook page. I have about three different installments on Prince. My hypothesis is that he indeed was a prince, that he was of royal bloodlines. He was of the ancient royal bloodlines. And I'm drawing this inference from the fact that he was never able to father a child. None of his consorts or his wives or mistresses were able to conceive a child of him, because I'm suspecting, we don't know this for sure, I'm suspecting him of being an Rh negative person, which is an entirely different species than the bulk of humanity. Anyway, that's my hypothesis. This is exclusive and for your audience here. So something to think about. Because, you know, when we're talking about psychopathology and all the usual explanations of these criminals that are running rampant, or even the great minds such as Prince, I don't think the models and the explanations that were given today or we're studying in academia or any other research site, I don't think they're adequate to really understanding the problems and the issues that we're facing now. So over the past at least 10 years now, I have been veering widely off course within academia, within the university setting, purposely trying to research this type of alternative form of knowledge, crypto science, crypto history, crypto archaeology. For me, it's all grist for the mill, and it's all worthy and important, really, to discuss, because the usual ways of looking at our world through race, class, gender, and nationality, they're no longer adequate to the task. So we have to go much, much deeper than that. I know you've had guests on your program that range into that area, and I have learned from them.
Well,
a good deal.
I found what's best is that when there is something deep to be discussed, sometimes just discussing it in and of itself starts to bring light to the issue in a very kind of like a ripples out sort of formation. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
To talk about the dark things is the only way to bring light to them, essentially.
We have to look at the dark side, and I'm not inherently a dark person. I don't know. I think my being is probably more akin to yours, although I think you've gotten more serious as you've gotten further into your career. I mean,
my psychosis really has just simply gotten worse.
Yeah, it's gotten worse as the world's gotten worse, and you've gotten older and matured as well. I don't enjoy inhabiting this dark space. So I have any number of workarounds that I have, including, you know, meditation, recreation, the nutrition, the exercise, all the other types of activities that that everyday people need to engage in order to combat this great evil that has descended upon us, because it can be defeated. But we must exercise our own individual autonomy, our free will, our spirit, and enact our creativity, mobilize our creativity to meet this threat. And this threat will gradually recede as we get stronger.
I was talking about this very subject with a friend of mine just before the show today, about how these psychopaths work. And there was a question about, what do I do? You know, what do I do with this reality? With the, like, if psychopaths are like in control of most things, most institutions of influence, power, wealth, if it seems to have a psychopathic nexus that connects all of them, not working in concert, but more like a shark feeding frenzy, right? Mm-hmm. Where all the sharks have their own agenda, but they just share the same target, us.
True. And they engage in regular feeding frenzies with us as the target. So, so are you so asking me, the, how do we cope with these people?
Yeah. What the question this person was asking me was, is what mm-hmm. do you do with that? And I say, well, think about it in every way that they're possibly screwing you right now. All right? It's infinite, right? Now, contemplate about how many ways you could screw them back. It's also infinite, isn't it? So you it can is. You can mess with them in any way that you wish, but you've got to be really creative about it, and you've got to enjoy doing it. And it can be as simple a thing as raising your kids right with love, right? Because they, the psychopaths don't want you to do that. They want people who are unbalanced, who are easy to manipulate, who have a daddy issue or something like that, that they can poison and feed off their fear and manipulate them and turn them against their friends and isolate them and destroy their careers and their businesses. They don't want people who are balanced. They don't want people not who have all. Strong families and things like that, mate.
And this is why I agree with you. This is why our best defense against their malignant beings is to live well, is to have family, to have friends, to look well, right? To behave in a fashion that confounds them, that is being happy with ourselves, not being miserable, and not giving into the negativity that they're sending towards us. And that really, really frosts them. It just, they just don't know how to deal with it. And I know this because this is what's been going on for the past 3 or 4 years at my institution. They've thrown everything they can at me, almost everything. And none of it's worked, and none of it will work. I have the moral high ground, and I have a very strong spirit going back to my family line. And that's really what's important, your family line, your heritage, right? You had that Maori warrior on recently. What's his name?
Ruben Taipari.
Yes. Oh, he exudes that warrior spirit. And each of us, no matter who we are, have that background. We have to reconnect it. But you see what the dominant popular culture has done. It's cut us off from that. It's made it to a fantasy sport, a video game, or a blockbuster movie. Or it's transported it to the some sort of mystical past, like in The Lord of the Rings, right? Your great national director, Peter Jackson, right? I mean, but you know, Tolkien knew what it was about. He really knew what it was about. He was looking at the ancient roots of our cultures and our humanity. So yeah, once you tap into that, man, nothing can take you down. So you have to study the history. You have to study your own individual history, your heritage. Get in touch with it, feed from it, feed off that energy and take it forward, because these other people are hollow shells. They're the hollow men, the hollow women, the Napolitanos. They hide behind their little pieces of legislation, rules and regulations, academic personal manuals, whatever. But when you get down to it on a human level, it's no contest.
Yeah. They appear to have everything, but they're really just people with nothing.
Right. Keep that in mind. It looks like they, you know, they're a formidable foe. But if you do indeed reach back into who you are as a human being and you reach back into your family line, your bloodlines, right, whether it's Rh negative or whatever it might be, with that type of knowledge, that'll take you really, really far in this world. This is what I've learned up to this point. And by the way, they don't talk about this in academia, not even in the biology department, right? Where am I learning this? I'm learning it from programs such as yours, who have alternative thinkers, some of whom, by the way, have been kicked out of academia, right? One brilliant man in particular, Joseph Farrell, right? Oxford trained. I don't know what happened. They probably kicked him out because he was a little bit too far off the beaten track there. But it's off the beaten track we need to go in order to rescue this world civilization of ours.
It also happened to Dr. Kevin Barrett when he started talking about 9/11 being impromptu blamed on Muslims and possibility of it being an inside job, got kicked out of his university, chased.
Absolutely.
Everything but the torches and pitchforks.
My friend and dear colleague, James Tracy, who has a program of his own called Realpolitik, he was fired over the holidays from Florida Atlantic University for daring to raise the possibility that the Sandy Hook school shooting has all these different anomalies that haven't been accounted for. He was fired. He has four small children.
This comes to a point that I've been trying to make with people. People have this delusion that the truth is more powerful than a lie. It's not. You know why? Because the truth is only the truth. It's only one thing. A lie is infinite. If one lie doesn't work, they can come up with another one and another one and another one and another one and pile them all on top of each other just to bury the truth underneath the lies, right? That's why people prefer lies so much, because there's more use to it.
Well, once you're on that treadmill, you're expending a lot of energy coming up with new lies, new fabrications, new evasions, new cover stories. All we have to do is one very simple act of telling the truth. Not to disagree with you, but the truth will prevail in the long run.
It does. It's the tortoise and the hare, right? That's the one with the patience, the one that just keeps doing the same thing and plodding along or whatever, versus the cocky one who just makes it up as he goes along.
They will flame out eventually. I've seen it happen in my own life amongst people I work with time and time again. So my advice is you run the clock on them. It's like a basketball game or it's a football game. You run clock. That is your game. It's not the boundaries of the field or the pitch or the court. It's not your opponent. It's the clock. It's time. Father time.
Well, you totally reminded me of like three people that have like screwed over. One was a talk radio show host and he like wound up having a divorce from his wife and she took half of everything. And another guy was another talk radio show host who like stole an idea from me and he's in jail now. And another person, a psychopath who I worked with on some DVDs as well, he wound up going to jail on 36 counts of fraud. So it works. It absolutely works. There are three words that you tell somebody who is unsure of themselves but has the right idea and is doing the right thing. Stay the course.
Very true. I mean, it's been said over and over again, but it's true. There's a reason why it's part of our moral heritage. Stay the course and stay true, and thou shalt not lie. Do not lie. Just stay with the truth. It's so simple, but for, as you described in the psychopath, for some people, a certain narrow subset of the human population, they can't do it for whatever reason. They habitually fall into these errors of lying, deceit, cheating, robbing, lying, stealing. They can't help themselves. Not to excuse them, they should be punished. I'm glad that they are in jail for their misdeeds. But in the meantime, they wreak havoc on the society and people's lives.
Now, I wanted to talk about the thing that actually kind of initially sort of brought you into the headlines. It was talking about the desexualization of Asian American males in the media.
Oh, that's something like 14 years ago. It's been quite a while, but you've done your homework. Well, in the American media, at least, and I think probably in the world media, outside of China and Japan and the Asian countries. And by the way, that's how I get around it. I watch Japanese movies primarily and home dramas. I don't watch a lot of American television. I have a TV, a very small one. And I watch certain movies just to kind of keep my hand in it, because my area is in mass media, in popular culture. But what I did was not to just complain about it and cry about it and wring my hands. I made my own all-Asian American erotic film. And this is what I did 14 years ago. And it sounds crazy, I know, but it did have a practical impact of getting some actors work. Right, Harold and Kumar goes to White Castle. I don't know if you saw that.
I did.
The original one. All right, it's a funny movie. It's a road movie. They said, "Hey, that there's a crazy guy up at UC Davis who made an all Asian American erotic movie. Wouldn't it be funny if we made the lead characters Asian Americans?" So they got the jobs, and it became a franchise. And so we've seen a little bit of improvement there, but really, again, you're getting back to the same problem. Is that These huge institutions in which psychopaths rule, we're talking about Hollywood right here, and I think most of your audience have an inkling of the sort of eyes wide shut reality that a lot of them live in. Who wants to be a part of that institution anyway? So the solution, is, such as yourself, is to, you're a good example of this, is to engage in independent media. Right, to do it yourself, make your own movies, have your podcasts, your vidcasts, whatever it might be. You don't necessarily have to break into these giant systems, which are all wrapped up anyway, right? They're all wrapped up, and they're mostly set pieces, professional sports, mostly, you know, the fix is already in, right? It's for entertainment purposes and for gamblers. So why even bother with it? You know, why don't you just go out and join a club team or just work out on your own. There's all kinds of workarounds that are available to us. If we just say, no, I'm going to opt out on this. I don't want to be a part of it.
Yeah, I get like that anytime somebody on the phone, "Hey, Vinny, I want to give you some money to do this particular task for me." "Hey, Vinny, I want to give you a job." "Hey, Vinny, I want to make your dreams come true."
My gosh. Yeah, and pretty soon you're on the outside looking in on what you created, right?
Well, that's exactly what I've just felt right now. It's like, oh my God, have I created a fish bubble, you know, a fish bowl around me where the only people that are around me are people who aren't complete cunts?
Well, you want to be on the inside. You don't want to have your hard work being taken from you, because that's what they're after, right? Isn't that what they're after? Well, and then you'll be working for them.
It's funny you should mention
this is something that you've probably been trying to avoid all your working career. That's what most of us, myself included, are trying to attain and maintain a reasonable level of autonomy, creative, intellectual autonomy, financial autonomy. This is what we're striving for. Freedom, in other words. What a novel concept. And we have all these piranhas, all these sharks who do nothing else but just think of ways to deprive people of autonomy, freedom, creativity, and take people who are actually creating value, who are innovating, and suck that energy for themselves, for their own purposes.
The problem with people that have a conscience is they think that everybody has one.
True.
You know?
One of my biggest failings, I say this over and over again to my friends, and your friends are very important in this journey, is that I give people the benefit of the doubt. I give them too much credit for honesty, for qualities that I assume that most people have. And most people do, but there's a large subset that don't. They're utterly lacking in these basic qualities that we assume most of us share. Yes. Unfortunately, we have to grow up, mature, and become aware of these people who are out there who do not share the same values, outlooks, and orientations that we do.
I find the most dangerous ones are the ones that you look up to and you go, wow, they're so amazing and they're so awesome and such and blah, blah, blah. Sheep to the slaughter.
Yeah. They range from political leaders, spiritual leaders. Remember when the Beatles went to India and studied with the Maharishi?
Yeah.
Well, you don't remember.
It might have been a bit before my time.
That's before your time. But anyway, to finish the story, what he just turned out to be a groper. John Lennon was quite embittered by the fact, oh, he's just a dirty old man. So my saying is, watch out for the guru. He's only trying to screw you.
We did a Facebook thread on my page today about name something that's impossible to avoid in the modern era. And it's become a very long thread of all the things you would expect. But one thing I thought up was actually quite interesting is false prophets who claim to have the solutions. This is something that's impossible to not encounter in the modern age, isn't it?
It is. They've always been around, but they seem to have multiplied lately because, as we alluded to earlier, we're in a civilization, we're in a point in history where we need solutions, right? And there are any number of charlatans who are ready to step forward and provide fake solutions to very complex problems. And they're from all walks. And they're in academia. I mean, my world is filled with such people. Now, fortunately, they don't care enough about their own jobs to take it really big time, right? They're just happy to be drawing a regular monthly salary. But if you put these people in a setting where it's a mega church of thousands of people and viewers all over the world, or the head of state of a country with millions of people, then you run into big problems. And that temptation is looking at us in the face right now. And we have to be very, very careful individuals who are trying to sell us a dream, because that's all it is. It's a dream.
There were two men. One of them was very frugal, and he lived a very Spartan-type lifestyle, and he saved his money. And he wound up getting a house. But he had to really endure a lot of hardship in order to get that house. While his friend wasn't so frugal. And he had a flash car and he was living in a nice place. And he had a really beautiful wife and he had kids and all of these kind of things. But one day, he couldn't pay his mortgage. And he lost everything, including his family. That kind of living what you haven't earned yet mentality has been all pervasive with the advent of the credit card, higher purchases and things like this. People can spend money that they don't have. People can live lives that they cannot afford. And it becomes indentured servitude after a certain point, because half the reason why you have a job is to pay off all the debt that you got yourself into when you spent money that you didn't have.
Absolutely. And I'm old enough to remember the days before the credit card, and I was raised by my parents to pay for everything in cash. Cash on the barrelhead, as the saying goes, cash and carry. Those values, that reality went out the window a long time ago. And by the way, just as a point of information here, the person who's the innovator, the major innovator, and I think he was put up to it. I don't know if he is inherently as smart as all that, but I think some very crafty bankers used him as the front man. But he came up with the diner's card. His name's Alfred Bloomingdale. That was the beginning of the end, the diner's card. Right, enjoying sumptuous meals on credit. Now, if you're a business person, because in the early days of credit cards, only the businessmen and the traveling public and elite segments of society had a credit card. But then you had this guy named Shailesh Mehta, who had a PhD in physics or something, joined this company, a little small company called Providian. And he decided to democratize debt. So he started giving credit cards to everybody, including people who had no income. Beautiful, wonderful. Because if the people don't pay, why, you know, they can write down the loss or maybe be bailed out by the public.
Or
Shailesh Mehta, he lives in the U.S. in a miniaturized version of the U.S. White House. He's living the American dream. By the way, that's my current book, is about Asian Americans who've made it in America.
Yeah.
It's called Servant. And so Shailesh Mehta is a case study because they use Asian immigrants. I don't know how it is in New Zealand, but they use Asian immigrants in the United States to help provide the scientific and technical information that puts us deeper into the surveillance state to help produce genetically modified organisms, also to create surveillance systems, as I mentioned, but also to help bust out, to develop new financial models in Wall Street. They call them quants, as in quantitative methods, to come up with new elaborate financing schemes that have no relationship to empirical reality, but can be sold to municipalities, to pension funds, so that the average Joe can be looted.
Hey, I've got a new product for you. Is the product good? No.
Please.
Is it dangerous? Yep. Is it really, really, really that bad? Yep. Would morons buy it if you lied to them? Probably. All right, let's sell it.
Absolutely. Weren't you in sales at one point?
I was.
Right, and the saying is, don't sell the steak, sell the sizzle.
There'd been times in sales where I would call someone up and I'd try to give them a better deal than they were currently getting now on their phone calls. And it turns out that they were getting a better deal than I could offer them. So what I would tell them is say, I know a company over here actually that can get a better deal than you got, even better than I got. And I'm going to hook you up and actually be on the phone call with you so that they can adjust your rates. Mm-hmm. Right. If we don't got it, we give it to you. That's sort of like an ethical business model. You know what really doesn't do well in sales? Having ethics. You know, I only did sales for 2 years for it wore me down. I was just like, no, man, I can't do this anymore, man. There's too many people around me who, you know, they're not making as much money as me. I'm being honest, but they're lying, right? And they're still making plenty of coin. Not as much as me, because I've just got the gift of the gab, son.
Right. And
it just occurred to me that I didn't want to do this. It was like, this is wrong. Even though I'm doing something nice for people on the other end, the people that I'm working for don't actually care about that as much as they care about getting the money in, which didn't gel with me. Right? Because it meant I was playing a part in their schemes. And the real thing that really tipped it off is when the boss of my bosses asked me to come into his office and tell me what I think we should do with the company. My bosses got really pissed off about that. And that's the thing. When you're better than the people above you and they're a psychopath, they don't give you a fair shake. Right.
Have you ever told this story before on your program?
I don't think so.
It's wonderful because it encapsulates, it covers a lot of ground. Because what you described to me just now, Vinny, is exactly my working situation, right? I don't know what sort of boiler room scheme you were operating in. You were selling telecom, right?
I was actually operating in the largest, one of the largest New Zealand-owned telecommunications companies in the country.
And you were the number one salesperson,
the
right?
Number one salesperson for my division of residential sales, yeah.
Sure, and that's a major accomplishment. They probably sent you on
solid. Nobody got a single score bigger than me on any night.
There you go. You're good. You're a great communicator. All right. But it may sound like a stretch, but that model that you just laid out, right? The managerial model and the whole motivation and people not really caring at the upper levels about what they're providing. They're just interested in the sizzle, right? And what money that you, as a person below them in the pyramid, are generating for them. That is exactly how the university functions. Does that sound like too much of a stretch?
No. As the saying goes, shit always rolls downhill.
Yeah, and it rises to the top too in a punch bowl.
Well, I found the pond analogy to be really good with that. I mean, where does the scum accumulate? on the surface, what does the scum do? It chokes out all the light and all the nutrients from the sun to everything beneath it so that it stagnates and dies.
Mm-hmm. So I need a larger and fresher pond, Vinny. Is there any room down there for me? Is there room for one more down in New Zealand?
You need something industrial. You need something toxic, okay?
Something extractive, right? Something with bulldozers.
Well, I found the infinite advice. I've interviewed a lot of people about psychopaths. I've interviewed people about demon possession. I've interviewed people about the ancient Wetiko virus and archons and so on and so forth and all these other manifestations of bad and evil in this thing. And you know what all interestingly agree on is the correct approach? Get the fuck out of there. Have no contact with them whatsoever. You cannot win. You're in a losing battle. You're going to, you know, you're going to get corrupted, I think. And I found the worst thing, you may have had this happen to you, when a friend or a family member or something like that, you get really aggro at them or something like that because you're talking about a psychopath who's fucked you over. And you've got that anger about that person, but you're projecting it onto them. You know, not deliberately, you're not just going, oh, I'm really angry at you. You're just angry while you're saying it.
Sure.
And they feel hurt by that. And that's part of the magic of the psychopath. They turn you into a poisonous bomb to your own support network.
Mm-hmm.
Boom! It's like, damn, they're a sneaky little viral possession organism or something like that. It's like they've been honing their skills, scumbaggery, I call it, for thousands of years, you know?
Live for it. Mm. They probably pass it down generationally, as you allude to. Who knows? It could be part of their DNA. Yes, a wise woman once told me a long time ago, she said she summarized it in one word. Which echoes your own sentiment. I mean, the people that told you, right, get out of there. She said, extricate. One word, extricate. Get the hell out of there. But in the meantime, when you deal with them, you know, you have certain defenses that you can use in order to keep them in bay. Just as when a mugger runs up on you on the street, right, there's certain ways you can kind of keep them off of you. Until you can either run away or to figure out a defense.
That's same way with psychopaths. And I've been told that the problem with anxiety and the reason it alters people's brains in some cases permanently, like they'll develop phobias or disorders because of traumas that happen to them. Like me, I've got employophobia. If I get anywhere near a job interview, I near on have a panic attack. I have a fear of gainful employment, which is a mental disease that I made up and self-medicate with weed for. Okay, so the thing about this is when you're under constant threat and attack, it's different to when it's sporadic. Sporadic is when you're in nature and you see a flash of orange and you think it's a tiger and you run for it. You run for maybe a minute or two, huff and puff, but you're out of danger. The reason why I think human beings are now suffering from more mental illness and illness in general than ever before is that there is a constant aura of threat about everything, everywhere, all the time.
Mm-hmm. And that is engineered threat as well. It seems to be inescapable. But again, it goes back to my earlier statement. There are certain defenses or protocols that an individual can adopt in order to bring down that leveling of anxiety to a workable level. But again, a certain level of anxiety is, I think, essential to our survival. I was just having a phone conversation with a colleague of mine earlier today, and she says, how do you come up with all these great creative ideas, all these different workarounds? And I said, listen, I've had the piranhas snapping at me most of my life, right? So I had to become resourceful. I had to become a hustler. I always had to come up with plan A, B, C, D, and all the way down the line. So in a way, I'm thankful to all these people who try to take from me what is mine. And speaking of jobophobia, is that what you called it, jobophobia?
No. Employophobia, a fear employer-phobia. Of
okay. This 20-year tenure at the University of California, Davis, that's the longest time I've ever been in one place. So to me, every year that I'm there is icing on the cake. It's a miracle because I'm a chronic unemployable person with a really, really bad attitude.
I think it reminds me of Lewis Black's father. He became like 88, right? And he decided he wanted to be an artist.
Never too late.
And he made it. No, he actually started making art, you know?
Absolutely. In his 88, that's a double infinity.
Right. And he got to 96, and he goes to his son and he says, you know, son, I think I'm done doing art for now. And he goes, but Dad, why? And he goes, well, he was honest. And he goes, well, I just ran out of ideas.
I thought you said he was going to start another career.
Well, no. I didn't.
All right. Well, it all comes to an end at some point, but I guess the trick is try to prolong that horizon, or put that horizon off in the distance as far as you can.
The coping mechanisms, dealing with psychopaths and things of that nature, you know, of course, there's the big red flag one. Hey, get out of there. But if you can't get out of there, there's people who are married to a psychopath. They have children with them, or one of their children is one, you know?
That would be awful.
Yeah, I was talking to a woman at a party once, one of my listeners, and she said one of her friends, she goes, oh, how's your son? And he goes, he has no soul. Like, there's nothing there. Right? And I just think it's trying to contemplate that. The fruit of your own loins is not anymore, right? Something changed. It's like they went to a cult or something, and then they come back. What they were wasn't there anymore. And I think this is what is happening to society on a broad brush scale, don't you think? They're trying to mold us into something that we're not, right? They want to make us afraid of everybody, but what happens in a big crisis? Everybody starts helping each other all of a sudden for a while. But as soon as it becomes constant, like as happened in Christchurch, I was speaking to a reporter who lives down there, and he said after maybe the first earthquake, for 3 months, everybody was helping each other. It was great. It was like a big community thing. But because the earthquakes continued, because everything kept shaking, tens of thousands of earthquakes a year, they didn't feel happy with each other anymore. Now nobody speaks to each other. That's what he was telling me. I'm thinking, whoa, that's kind of like giving steroids to the same sort of very general vibe that we're all getting all year round through the media and the fucking satellites or whatever the fuck poisons we're exposed to in our air and our water and our food and the BPA and this and the goodness knows what. I could give you 1,000 things, literally 1,000 things plus that are currently making you sick. 200, which are chemicals that can be detected in the, the tube for the babies and stuff like that, bro. All right. Oh my God. It's a really bad, shitty situation. So I prescribe laughter because, hey, as Lincoln said, I'd rather, if I didn't laugh, I'd cry. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. There's a listener-supported broadcast, and we will be right back after the break. Don't you go anywhere, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio. My very special guest, Daryl Hamamoto, is that how you pronounce it? I hope so, is my very special guest. And we've been talking for the last hour or so about psychopaths and trauma and scumbaggery, etc. And now we're going to be talking about some coping mechanisms, which might be handy and prove fruitful. Daryl, take it away.
Yeah. Yes, sir. So you wanted to know about antidotes to scumbaggery?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of my job.
Okay. keep close to your friends. Avoid the toxic individuals. For example, I try to stay away from work as much as possible. The work site itself has a very creepy, eerie feeling around it. And I have this sense, this premonition of great violence and evil that's about to break out there for some reason. Because as you know, in America, there has been an outbreak of violence, violent types of attacks, some of them staged events, but most of it down to the overprescription of psychotropic drugs. So that is a campaign that I've been involved with, not to promote them, but to identify them as being the scourge that they are. And this, by the way, is one of the main reasons why I found myself in such difficulties at the University of California, Davis, because the former chair of my department was the recipient of $1.5 million American dollars per year from the so-called National Institute of Mental Health in order to convince young people that they have some sort of mental debility or mental illness, which would stigmatize them. It would go into their files or primitive files, and plus it would make them patients for life for psychotherapists and for psychotropic drugs. And I think most of your viewers are savvy and educated and aware enough to know the dangers, the risks of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and the way that the big pharmaceutical companies have marketed them specifically to young people. And within that, particularly targeting women, young women. And I started noticing that in my classes about 10 years ago. And I tried to figure out what was going on here. And I asked around and I talked to one of my colleagues at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She runs a creative writing program. And she said, it's the antidepressants. She says, all my students are on them. They're high strung. They're delicate, right? So what we're seeing here with all these social justice warriors, right? This is the culmination of a twofold process. One is this Prozac revolution, the antidepressants, and the other is this weaponization of the race, class, gender. I call it weaponized multiculturalism that has become institutionalized in the university. And you bring those two together and you have a volatile mixture. So I like to stay away from campus as much as possible. On the other hand, I do have some really good students as well. They're diminishing in number, but the ones that I do have are excellent. And I do have some excellent colleagues as well. But I've seen a dark transformation, a dark cloud that has descended upon the institution. That cloud must be lifted. And even if I have to do it single-handedly, I'll do it. I'll try. At least I'll make the attempt. So, yes. Medications, pharmaceuticals, not necessary. Bring back compulsory physical education, K-12 in American school systems. Bring back physical education at the universities. They used to be mandatory. And get people back in touch with their bodies at a healthy level. And strictly limit the use of these pharmaceuticals that have been marketed so aggressively over the past 20 years in particular.
It's a big scope, and I was thinking about this earlier today, actually. You can't go from drugs, you know, will protect me and help me, they're safe, they have no side effects, I trust my doctor, I trust my government, all the way over to the medical system is a cartel run by mafia of industrialists who create bioweapons marketed as therapeutic medicines that infect people with incurable diseases that they can sell them drugs to for the rest of their life, that manage the symptoms of the diseases without curing it overnight. You know, you can't just come to a conclusion like that all of a sudden, can you?
Especially if you're doped up, narcotized, and you're in that fishbowl, you don't know that you're trapped into it. And that's the delicate part of getting my message across to students, because if you start sharing with them this information, many of them will get very defensive because you're taking away their God. Their God is Soma, as Aldous Huxley calls it. right? You take away their God, and you are really playing with fire with your own career. And I've talked about this problem to administrators where I work, but what I found in almost every single case is that they're also on drugs, or their kids are on drugs. So they think I'm judging them. I'm saying, no, I think we need to reevaluate the situation and get back to the basics, right? Be sad if your boyfriend or girlfriend dumped you. Deal with a hurt. Feel your pain.
Doctor,
life is not just one giant pity party. Deal with it. Man up.
Doctor, I'm going through a really hard, ordinary life experience. What have you got for me? Well, I've got some shit that might make you kill yourself.
That's a really good solution. Not really.
Why haven't you just told this to me before? What else have it got in store for me? Well, some diarrhea, some nausea, maybe some bleeding of the bowel. It'll be all fun rides and circuses. And also, if you ever try to come off of it, that's when it'll be the worst for you. And it'll last for a really, really long time.
Mm-hmm. And if they come off it really quickly, that's when I'm put in jeopardy. That's when these people start coming on campus. Right. And they're created. They're manufactured. We know this from a book by Alston Chase called Harvard and the Unabomber. Right. In the 1950s, Harvard University was experimenting on students with very powerful mind altering drugs. And it wasn't just an abstract study of the mind of the neurological system. I think the ultimate attempt, because this was under contract from the Central Intelligence Agency, I think the ultimate goal for that was to roll it out into the general population. And that's what we're seeing now in 2016. It's an excellent book, Alston Chase, Harvard and the Unabomber. And for the listeners who don't know who the Unabomber was, he was a person back in the 1980s who targeted certain people who were supposedly destroying the environment. And he would send bombs to them, finely crafted bombs, and they would either be killed or maimed. But he was a creation of the university pharmaceutical complex, Harvard University in particular, the same institution that your prime minister went there to get his MBA, right? His vaunted Harvard Master of Business Administration.
Well, they just proved that you don't need to do 7 years of university in order to get some MDMA.
No, you don't. You can just do a one-year quickie executive MBA, and then they'll send you back to your home country so that you can loot your fellow citizens and then send it back to the city of London.
It's
what a great formula. Great. I hate to
fly, my pretties. Fly! It's just
we're
like
being
that.
Attacked. You know, the flying monkeys are overwhelming us.
Did you know that's actually become a term in modern psychology is flying monkey syndrome? When somebody
really?
Gets manipulated by a psychopath and then sent after their real target?
Well, you know the solution to that. Just throw some water on the bitch. And then the monkeys come over to Dorothy's side. Isn't that true?
Oh, we.
That's the Wizard of Oz. Check that scene out again. The monkeys cool right back down after the Wicked Witch melts.
Yeah, well, then, as soon as you take out the, what was it? How do you kill a snake? You cut off its head.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's the thing. There's a subset. It's called proto-psychopaths. They're just underneath the psycho, but they're like their underlings. You know, they're the ones that actually get put in the way. They're like the middlemen. They're like the low-level drug dealer, that kind of thing, versus the big CIA guy that is actually flying it in the giant cargo planes that are on loan from the U.S. Fire Service with a different manifest with $1 billion worth of cocaine on board with a sticker that says evidence, you know? That kind of thing.
I recognize the type, yes.
Not in specificity, but...
No, in my world, these are the people that are compulsive memorandum writers. They like to keep book and document everything you're doing and sending this up the pyramid so that they can feed this into their investigation. By the way, I'm currently under investigation at the University of California, Davis, and the administration has contacted students to turn them into informants against me, snitches and rats. This is within the last couple of days. This is what the University of California has become. It's become a surveillance system, only secondarily an institution of higher learning, a surveillance slash money laundering and money generating machine for Wall Street.
And a mind control institution.
They're blowing up the life sciences. They're blowing up different types of pursuits to jack up the value on Wall Street for these new science-based innovations. And then they pump up the bubble, and then they bust it, and they come up with something new.
Mm.
They did it with the internet. Now they're doing it with the life sciences economy. You name it. It's pump and dump.
Yep. Apparently, you can steal billions of dollars, and all you need, really, is a piece of paper with a signature on it. You can create companies that do nothing, and you can promote them and all of that kind of thing, and you can steal people's seed capital. It's
absolutely.
It's the thing. It's the reason. Why do people think, ladies and gentlemen, let me ask you a question. Why is it that all the people that are in control of your life or that have some kind of authority over you tend to be real dicks who are often real psychopathic, all right? Now, here's the reason why. When you've got three people vying for one particular job position and one of them's a real psychopathic dick, he can sabotage and spread rumors and lies about the other two people who are competing for the same job. This gives him an unfair advantage. He can also lie about who he is and what he's done in order to qualify himself for that job and position. This also gives him an unfair advantage. You see, the reason why these people keep winning the game is because they figured out that if you don't play by the rules, you don't have to earn things like other people do, like earn a reputation. You can just lie and say that, hey, I had breakfast with Nelson Mandela last week.
And great, let me invest all this money with you so you can steal it from me. Yeah, that seems to be the modus operandi for these high-level psychopaths.
But this, you know, is what? The reason
we know
why
this,
it
Vinny.
Corrupts a lot
we
of people.
Know this. How do we subvert their game?
There isn't.
How do
really
we undercut
any.
Them?
There isn't really any. The only way to win the game is to start playing your own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no way outside of their control structure. I've seen. You know, I know a lot of people have tried to like get outside the system and do all these legal remedies and whatever the hell. They all wind up going to jail or suffering or losing their families or their private property or whatever the fuck. So that doesn't work. These people have been in control of the world since forever, since civilization has been here. Psychopathic individuals have ruled civilization. And my theory is...
We talked about the bloodline.
Yeah,
yes.
My theory is that they've got a game where they will pump up not only companies, but societies. It's a trickle-down system. The exact same methodology will trickle down into all the other systems virally, as it were. And what this virus does is it injects power and energy into a situation and pumps it up so that it becomes big, inflated, and juicy, and then it pops it and then spreads its disease to other things that it can pump and pop as well, exactly as a virus does to a human cell. A virus injects itself into the cell, replicates itself within it, and then it explodes, and then boom, the entire body is infected. Now, this is how they've gotten control of all of our institutions without really raising much of an eyebrow, because we're dealing with an infection, I think, a very, very smart, highly evolved infection that has a fight or flight response that is second to none. We're talking about near psychic ability to sense a trap, to sense that they're being set up, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Real scary, kind of like going back to the Dark Ages when we were when we were slaves to overlords who told us that they were gods and shit, you know? Psychopaths evolve. Over time, they just tell you different lies about themselves. They used to tell you that they were a god, but now they just tell you that they're president. And you give them the same awe and appreciation and love that they want, but can never manifest themselves because they have nothing. and they need to take it from us.
At the same time, the peasantry, that's us, has also evolved. We've become better educated, more long-lived. You would think that we've figured out a means of not just exposing their game, but of reducing or countering the power that they have over us. It's not quite happening yet, but I think it might. It might. I think there's a strong possibility that because of this explosion of independent researchers, talented amateurs included, it's not coming from academia, that's for sure. Very little of it is. Most of it's coming from outside the university.
That's because
which
crazy.
Is the ultimate. It's the ultimate viral infested institution, quite medieval in origins and also in the present day. So that's what I'm hoping for, and that's what I'm working toward. Because it's not acceptable for me to understand who the bad guys are and what they're doing. The third stage is to change it, to transform it, and to return the power that the Creator endows in each and every one of us as free and sovereign human beings. Return that freedom, that sovereignty, that creativity to ourselves, and to run our lives how we see fit in cooperation with others. Other like-minded people, and to keep the percentage, the small minority of what you call psychopaths, keep them in abeyance, right? We can never eliminate them completely, but let's keep them on hold. Let's keep them off to the side where they can do minimal damage, as opposed to today where they're in control.
Have you heard of the paranormal researchers Ed and Elaine Warren?
I have not. Please tell me more.
Basically, the ghost hunters of American history, right? Like, the movies have been based on the stuff that they've done in real life, right? Mm-hmm. And Elaine Warren's had this quote one time, and I thought it was very interesting. She says, "Evil can be contained so long as we remain vigilant, but it can never truly be destroyed."
I would agree with that that assessment, yes. But vigilance is the key word, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And all the different institutions, whether it's education, media, sports, have conspired to make us non-vigilant, to make us susceptible, to make us distracted.
Complacent, domesticated.
Complacent and domesticated. And that puts us in a state of grievous vulnerability. And we must relearn these basic survival skills. And one of them is vigilance, right? You want to kind of keep your senses sharp so that you're not eaten by a bear or a wolf or a coyote or fall over a cliff. You need to sharpen your survival skills. It's a lot of us have lost them because the government or some institution, our company, our corporation, provides the illusion of taking care of us, the security. So we've lost that. We can recapture it, though, because it never really falls away. It's just dormant within ourselves.
It reminds me of this one time when I told Cliff High. God, if anybody hasn't heard my interview with Cliff High, just go Google Cliff High, Vinny Eastwood. It's great. But I said, humanity is like a spring, you know, you can push it down, but as soon as you've pushed it all the way down, you've got to keep pressure on it constantly, otherwise it's just going to spring up again, right? Mm-hmm. And he says, "No, Vinny, I respectfully disagree. Humanity is like a water spring. Let's use an organic example. What happens when you try to push a water spring down? It starts spewing off to the side and burrowing through rock and carving new paths and new ways, and then cropping up in different areas where it would never have done before had you not tried to keep it down. That's mm-hmm. what humanity is." And I was like, "Whoa, that's really inspiring realization right there, cunt."
Yes, and I'd like to spew all over my enemies, that's for sure.
like in the
and
fly.
They have been. No, we are irrepressible human beings. Our creativity, our energies, our humor, our expressions of our humanity, in other words, are irrepressible. And that's really, really vexing to the ultra elite that want to keep us in a state of permanent subjugation.
You always want so what that, you don't
so
have.
Their workaround is, of course, is to create artificial intelligence and robotics, nanotechnology. And you know the story, the radical reduction of the human population. That is their solution to this intractable problem that they see it as a problem. I see that as our reality and our future. So again, we must be creative. We must come up with new ideas, new strategies. It's going to come out of the arts. It's going to come out of technology. It's going to come out of new communications, a variety of human endeavors to alert the general population that are willing to understand and to learn from this, and to create countermeasures against these people. All we have to do is pursue the truth, move forward, while they are coming up with the lies, the evasions, the rationalizations. We talked about this earlier in the program. So our task is really much simpler. All we have to do is stay the course of truth, the course of justice and righteousness. And that's a universal human endowment. These people, it drives them crazy. They just do not know they haven't figured out how to wring that out of us yet. Even with the powerful pharmaceuticals, they have not figured that one out.
I don't care what anybody's motivation is to try and be themselves, you know, just as long as they've got justification for it, and as long as their self isn't psychopathic scumbag. The other thing I wanted to discuss with you is about how, in terms of keeping yourself healthy, there's a healthy way of doing things. There's a healthy way of, you know, treating illnesses or depression and things of that nature. This is true. But in terms of healthy ways of thinking about things, healthy ways of taking things, you know, like if somebody says something to you and it really gets you riled up and it actually hurts your feelings, and like it cuts to your core. Like, let's say it's somebody who's been close to you for very much years and they've just said something that's so horrible to you that you just can't even fathom that they said it. What do you do in situations like that?
Does that happen to you very often? I don't encounter such situations, because one of my strategies to avoid people such as that. I mean, my friends can be very truthful to me, but if they are my friends, they would never say anything that would be purposely hurtful to me. Maybe inadvertently, yes, but we could be honest about it and discuss it. You know, that's not a problem. As for the other people who, and you know, you're a prominent figure, so you get this all the time. The haters, so called, who cares about them anyway? Who cares? You know, or the person you meet randomly on the street who said, Vinny Eastwood, you know, I think you suck. Your show's, you know, it's just crap. I mean, who cares? It doesn't bother me. I'm in a position myself in my own smaller world where I get all kinds of criticism and flack and whatever. Maybe it's my age. I don't know. I really don't care. I don't care. It doesn't bother me anymore. I'm going to say what I'm going to say. I'm going to write what I'm going to write. I'm going to produce movies or media, whatever it is that I want to produce. You can like it or not like it, or you could be indifferent. I don't care. I'm going to do it. Right? So maybe it's just an attitude adjustment that's required. Maybe I'm arrogant. Maybe I'm egotistical. Maybe I'm deluded. Who knows? I'm definitely not drugged. You know, don't touch the stuff. I have one cup of homemade, freshly ground coffee per day, and then green tea, you know, here and there. That's about it. Okay, that's all I need. But like I said, I feed off a lot of people's negative energy. I love the haters. I love the people who say, I can't do this, or don't do this, or we're going to investigate you. That makes me more innovative. That makes me more resourceful. That makes me more inspired to do what I do best, which is create.
I want to get that on a t-shirt. I heart the haters.
Yeah. Return their hate with indifference. Don't even bother giving them any love. Indifference is what they hate. Because, you know, they're psychopaths, right? They want attention, like you said. Don't give them the attention. Pardon me?
You just reminded me. I had this lengthy debate with somebody on Facebook or whatever. I occasionally indulge in it just to see if the waters have changed. Like for example, I'll eat McDonald's once a year just to see if it's gotten any worse. And it always does. Oh, man, almost, did I just lose what I was talking about?
The Facebook conversation. Facebook conversation.
Facebook conversation about what, though?
Testing the water.
Testing the waters.
Taking the temperature of your public.
Ah, oh, nah, it's gone. It's unfortunate.
All right, sorry.
Damn, okay. It happens sometimes.
It'll come back.
Yeah. It sometimes does, and sometimes not.
I don't find those back and forths on Facebook very fruitful or productive either.
No, they usually result in just block, and the scum is gone. Hey, I don't have to deal with this person again.
Yeah, so I don't know. I just post my information. I respond briefly to friends in particular. I mean, friends, not Facebook friends, friends. But other than that, I don't engage people on social media and Twitter or whatever. I just put my work out there and see what happens. Response, well, non-response, indifference. But I've got a pretty good – I have a good track record of getting people to respond to some of the work that I put out.
I remember it now.
All right, let's go for it.
He was insulting me, and I said, okay, insult me again. and he did, and I go, have you got another one? and then he stopped insulting me. What did it remind me of? It reminded me of what was it? The Dark Knight Returns, the Frank Miller version. There's the scene when Bruce Wayne is approached by these two gangsters, and they're talking about slicing him up and everything. And Bruce Wayne just clenches his fist. He's an old man, right? Mm-hmm. And he says, "Come on." And they suddenly back off a little bit, and they go, no, man, we can't do this if he's into it.
Yeah, it just befuddles them. They don't know how to respond. I get this.
Why aren't you afraid of me?
More recently, you know, we're talking about my situation at the university, but I had these social justice war. I think they were representative from the GLBTQ society. You know, they're mobilized, right? They've been manufactured. So they were sitting in the back, very back row, trying to sweat me and trying to challenge, you know, my different statement. I was just giving a lecture. And this has been going on for a couple of years now. So I kind of expected them to be there. And all I did, like you, was saying, okay, the next lecture, I'm gonna give you 20 minutes to present your perspective on it. They didn't show up to the class. They dropped it. So this is how you deal with hecklers. When you're a comedian, you just turn the attention to them. Here's your spotlight, Jack. You want the attention, Mr. Psychopath. You got it. What do you have? And they don't have anything because they're operating off really, really shallow ground here.
There was this.
They have nothing, or they're on a script.
You have to say,
okay, let's see what you got. Let's see what you have. Deliver it. Nothing.
Yeah. I remember this Australian comedian who went to see live, and he's a bit overweight, right? And one guy shouts from the back, "Why are you so fat?" And he goes, "Because every time I fuck your mother, she gives me a jelly bean."
Vinny, where do you think I got these insights? Going to shows like this, watching comedians and seeing how they deal with hecklers. And I said, I could take those ideas and implement them in my life. Because you're always being jacked with, you're always being heckled, you're always being hassled. Mm. So yeah, the comeback is great. And that shut the person up big time, right? He's probably with his girlfriend.
Oh yeah, you know? It was.
She was so embarrassed.
It was just a decapitation of Antoinette proportions.
Yeah, so I've seen comedians do that. I've seen this one great one was a guy had a flashlight. Whenever some drunk was back there trying to get attention, he would just put the flashlight on him, you know, and shine it on him. Okay, hey, it's your turn, Jack. You got the spotlight on you. Let's see what you got. Nothing. All right, so that's what we're going to do, the psychopaths. We just came up with an idea. We're going to shine a spotlight on these people. Let's see what you really have other than some sort of speech that's on a teleprompter, Hillary Clinton or whoever else is up there. Let's see what you're really made of, Barack Obama, Michelle Obama. Nothing. Hollowness.
Mm. There's an old expression. You can't fill a room with darkness because all you have to do is just turn on a light and it gets chased away. And once a room is full of light, darkness can't enter, right? This is how you live your life. That's what we were talking about earlier about, you know, truth, staying the course, and just basically doing the right thing. That's mm-hmm. just keeping a candle lit, right?
Sure.
To keep the darkness at bay. Because I found that we talked about vigilance, right? And I was thinking about corruptibility. Am I corruptible? Can I become a scumbag? Heaven forbid, you know? And I was thinking, what would it take to turn me into a scumbag? Ah, I know what it would be. To stop feeling guilty for my own little failings, right?
Hmm.
As soon as I stop yeah. feeling guilty entirely about the things that I do, the people I let down, or even it's the little things at first.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you lose that focus, as soon as you let down your guard and start to think to yourself, I'm incorruptible, I can't be challenged or anything like that, that's when they get you. It's like the body snatchers, man. They get you while you sleep.
Mm-hmm. So you let down your own guard. You become a little bit too confident in your own sense of self and maybe a little bit of hubris or arrogance. Yeah. In your own self-protectiveness, and that becomes your point of vulnerability. Yeah, I think that's a very important insight. So toward that end, I think a very important strategy in life is to just remain humble and humility. Because, you know, I'm probably, to your audience, I come off as a very arrogant, aggressive person, right? I am that because I teach. I'm a communicator, right? I'm a writer. That's what I do. I have to get my point across effectively to people. But within that, believe me, I am in awe of the great writers, the great artists, the great intellectuals, the great figures of history that have come before us. I'm humbled by them. I still want to learn from them. And I've retained that throughout my entire career as an educator myself. Right. So I don't know.
Well,
I might fall prey to hubris. That's why the Greeks came up with the term, right? It must be part of our human tendency or endowment. So they said, hey, let's call it hubris.
Yeah. Well, we all stand on the shoulders of giants that we much touch the sky. You know, I was at a protest one time and I was talking about exposing scumbaggery. What was it? Scumbaggery! We need to expose it! You know, that kind of thing in the middle of a protest. And a friend comes up to me and she goes, you know, Vinny, you're really just projecting your emotions and everything like that because it's actually about what's inside of you. And I go, well, that's exactly one of the things that I realized earlier on. Is that if you're going to expose scumbaggery for a living, the most important thing you can expose is the scumbaggery within yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a pretty perceptive comment from that woman there. A lot of what we do externally are rationalizations or evasions for what we're feeling about ourselves, right? Our own weaknesses, our own vulnerabilities. So, yeah, talk about vigilance, about people outside of ourselves, you know, the scumbags and the psychopaths. We also have to be self-vigilant, vigilant about ourselves, monitoring ourselves, and never losing that capacity to be critical of our acts. And you put it in terms of remaining remorseful or guilty about what you might have done, small acts or major, in your daily life. It's mindfulness, I would call it. And that's very important. If we all did that a little bit each day, wow, the world would be a much happier place. But at the same time, let's stay on top of the scumbags.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've got two tasks. One is to see and expose and give light to the bad things that you see around you. And two is to remain vigilant of the bad things that are naturally there within you, right?
And, absolutely.
Robert Anton Wilson, I love his initials, RAW, you know. He's a philosopher, right? You know, he says, the cosmic schmuck principle holds that if you don't wake up once a month at least and realize you've recently been acting like a bit of a schmuck again, then you'll probably go on acting like a schmuck forever. But if you do occasionally recognize your own schmuckiness, you might begin to become a little less schmucky than the general human average at this primitive stage of terrestrial evolution.
Well, I think that was well said. It was well put. It was a genius observation. I don't know if we're going to evolve out of this or whether it's just going to be a repeating circle. I happen to think it's cyclical, rather. And I think we're in a really, really bad part of the cycle. And we have to stay the course, endure, be on top of the scumbag so that we can come to the top end of the cycle where creativity and rebuilding and growth is possible. It's going to come. It's going to come. It's absolutely going to come because that's just the law of the universe. This eternal return, the cyclical movement rather than evolving out of our benighted state into something better, right? But we're all trying to, in our own way, trying to become, as it said, better versions of ourselves. I think we try that. That's part of our heritage as well, improvement, right? Self-regulation.
Yeah, I mean, that's what
moral
that's what we're supposed development. To do. I remember one time I was just like, I wonder what women's magazines look like. I wonder what they do and everything, you know, because I just learned about advertising and how to manipulate people's emotions and fears.
You don't read them?
No. And so I flipped through it.
You have to read the women's magazines.
And so I flipped through it and I was like, she's too fat, she's too thin, she's too that, or the other. You need this makeup, you need this. And it was like, oh my God, it's like watching a reality TV show with commercial breaks to sell you poisons. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is a poisonous concoction for your mind to think you're inadequate, right? And I was like, whoa. There are people who read this. And it reminded me of that the CIA discovered mind control is addictive.
Mm-hmm.
People will crave it.
Sure. Well, more specific, I think the best example of what you're describing is Cosmopolitan magazine, Cosmo, right? And it's right at the checkout center part of the grocery store. And, you know, women still do the bulk of the shopping. So that's where they have the magazines for your impulse buy. And the publishers, by the way, pay a premium to position their magazines right in that selling point. But you read Cosmopolitan and my gosh, they have what you're describing and more, right? Because there's also heavy behavioral programming. It's about, you know, self-gratification. Yeah, you please your boyfriend or your lover or whoever else in this and that other explicit way, right? You see on the covers how to give your boyfriend a raging orgasm, you know, whatever it is, right? But within those bounds, it is a psyops. It's a giant commercial psyops. And you wonder, how does a magazine like this survive in the age of internet, right? Probably because it's subsidized. You know, some sort of intelligent entity or agency probably puts it out there in the supermarket.
You mean like criminal banks who launder everybody's frickin' drug money at the same time and could create money out of thin air based on people's signatures and their position on the stock market? You know, it's just, you know, you can infinitely influence people. You can infinitely buy crap.
So you can give it away for almost free.
Who was it that said this? Right? It was, money is power. If you don't think so, then try getting the same level of influence on your local politician that a billionaire can, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so if money actually does give you the ability to influence politics, it means that the only people who will really be served by politics are those with the money.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if you've been following the American presidential campaign, but this might be a good point to... for me to ask you about Donald Trump, because he is a multimillionaire, yet he's the presidential candidate. And he's seen the top. He's been to the mountaintop, right? Is he sincere or is he selling us a bill of goods? I don't know. What's your take on it as an observer?
Well, I'll fire a question back at you. At what point have you participated in an election, or where any American has participated in an election, where the president that resulted from that election did any good for the fucking country?
It hasn't happened in a long time, but this is before I was eligible to vote.
Exactly.
I found John F. Kennedy to be highly inspirational. That was the last time I really, really felt good about an American president.
And what happened to him exactly?
He had that fateful meeting with a magic bullet and on that November day in a Masonic square in Dallas, Texas. Yes.
Yeah.
I was in grade school when the vice principal came around to tell us about the assassination. That was a quite profound moment in my life. But since that time, yeah, most of them would, the presidents after that would fit your description of scumbags.
Yep.
Right. Okay. Including the current president, with all due respect. But with all due disrespect.
Now, that's my question. But my actual answer to your question was I did an interview with Ed Opperman from the Opperman Report. He's also a host on American Freedom Radio now. And he's done actually a bit of digging. He's a private investigator that lives in Florida, right?
Right. Yeah, I've listened to a show.
And so he's found out that Trump's very good friends, very closest friends, three closest friends, America's, maybe even the world's, biggest drug dealers, money launderers, and human traffickers.
Ah, see, I'm learning something. That's why I asked you.
Mm.
So this is something new to me. This is something that I need to follow up on.
Compromise. Everybody's compromised. Even you and me, even though nothing we've done is really bad and benign or whatever, it can be hyped up and inflated to make it appear as though it is, to throw people off of voting. However, if you've got enough dirty laundry, you actually become a target for becoming a valued asset, because you can be blackmailed, you can be threatened, you can theoretically say anything your handlers want.
Sure.
And it's fear. Once they've got one over on you, I mean, I think what happens is, this is the US election. Over the last few years that I've been watching it, I went from Al Gore's going to save us. Okay, Bush won the election. Okay, 9/11's now happened. Okay, Bush gets reelected. How the F did that happen? How the F did he get elected in the first place with all the voter fraud and all of that kind of stuff? Oh, and now Obama's elected. Ah, everybody can calm down. Let's cry when he gets inaugurated. And he starts doing the exact same things, even worse than Bush did. And then, oh, now all of a sudden we've got this new truth movement. People who actually don't buy the mainstream media straight off the bat, but they still have vested interests, they still have these vested psychological needs for a leader. They don't want to be totally independent. They don't want to lead their own lives. They think that somebody can save them. They think somebody can make a difference. And those people have split into the right wing and the left wing. Truthers, people who will not vote for a Clinton or a Bush because they're Illuminati, they're New World Order, but they will vote for a Donald Trump. He's just a billionaire. You know, they will vote for a Bernie Sanders. He only supported the exact same legislation as the Clintons. You know, that's the thing. You can make people complacent by giving them false options, right? That dichotomy, because you can't get there without being compromised. This is the thing. The entire system's been compromised. That same viral psychopathology that trickles down into and infects all the other cells of the institutions has got a very firm grip, not only on the United States political system, but upon the people of the United States as a whole. It's infested their entire world. Every living room is alive with it. It's inescapable.
We're collectively ensorcelled.
Now, did you notice?
Top to bottom. Yes.
Did you notice between Obama being elected to this new election, a huge change in the normal everyday routine behavior of the average American citizen and what they're watching and all of that kind of stuff? No. It's been the same, isn't it? You're not seeing 9/11 as an inside job placards every time you're driving around to go get a bottle of milk. You're not seeing people with in the bankers, you know, in the Fed on street corners as you're going down into the office or anything like that. Nothing's really radically changed, but there's a subsect of society that has come alive online It's not visible in the real world, but it's really visible there. But it's become its own little echo chamber and fishbowl vision where we do the same infighting, the same nonsense, and the same messianic wish list bullshit that has kept everybody in a prison up to this point anyway.
Mm-hmm. And you're seeing this in conjunction with the Trump phenomenon, this repetition of the same, social psychology, I guess you'd call it. And from your observation, I'm inferring that you're highly skeptical of his candidacy. Now, I have to vet, with all due respect, Mr. Opperman's investigations, right, before I can comment on it. But that in itself, number one, does not shock me or surprise me. There's a reason. There's a trajectory that any millionaire is going to take in order to get to that position. So I'm sure he has plenty of dirty laundry. Now, that brings you to the second point. Does that necessarily disqualify him, in my mind, as a presidential candidate? Not necessarily, you know. But again, I have to look at the details. But the larger point here is that I am not personally going to surrender my own will, my own freedom, for a candidate or any one individual. If I'm supporting a presidential candidate, it could be John McAfee, who to me looks like the best person there who we never heard about, right? Or we don't hear anything about him. I'm looking for the person who's going to give me the maximum amount of freedom and autonomy that we were talking about earlier, and damn the rest, right? Really. So long as he's been not caught in bed with dead women or live children, you know, everything short of that, I'm almost okay with it, right? Because all of our institutions are corrupted with drug money, drug laundering. You know, I work for the University of California. It's a structurally corrupt institution. I work for it. I get my salary every month from them. But does that make me corrupt? Maybe by association. Will that cause me to leave my job out of self-righteousness? No, I'm going to stay there and be as much of a pest and an irritation to the people there who hate me as long as possible. So if Trump can do that for the American political system, be an upset stomach, an irritation, an irritable bowel, then great. Let's see it. Let's see what happens, and let's see what the American people are made of should he be lying to us, should he renege on his promises, including to demand the release of those 28 pages in the 9/11 report. That was one of his campaign pledges. Now, that's about as specific and concrete as you can get. If he can deliver on that, there might be some hope. Maybe he won't. Who knows?
Specifically, if I were able to vote in the upcoming election, I too would vote for Trump. Because when I vote for the entertainment value. And boy, would there be some chuckles and guffaws and chortles heard in my house when, during the inauguration ceremony, Trump gets inaugurated president and he turns to Obama and says, "You're fired."
Well, that would be the ultimate reality show. So far as I'm concerned, my own interest in who becomes president of the United States amongst all the different candidates is much more base than that. I think he has the hottest wife of all of them. So I'm going to go with her.
Well, you know.
Right? I mean, we saw the photos. It's supposed to be, it was supposed to scuttle his candidacy that she was seen semi-nude in a pose. Oh, that was beautiful. I mean, it's really brought American presidential politics to a new plateau of prurience, I guess you can call it. But yeah, it's wildly entertaining. It's engaging. But I think it's also substantive. Let's not forget that he's raised some huge issues about immigration, about the American economy, about industry, about international relations, especially vis-a-vis China. Now, whether he can implement those changes as one person, as a president, in this whole constellation of interest groups and lobbyists and financiers, I don't know, right? But look at Obama. He's one person. And look what he's accomplished.
Yeah.
Joblessness.
Kept Guantanamo Bay open.
Poor economy. Yeah, he's accomplished quite a bit in the negative sense as just one person.
I've held this as a philosophical belief about when you're looking at people with inordinate amounts of power and wealth and so on and so forth, in official positions and right. What are they doing there? What are they accomplishing? Are they doing a good job? That all depends on who you think they're working for.
You mean the presidents?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do know, or I think I have a fairly good understanding who Obama works for. He works for the Queen of England, who just celebrated her 90th birthday. She's probably going to live to be about 125 to 150, something like that, you know, with all the different
you hear that,
baby
ladies
proteins.
And gentlemen, running a pedophile cult does pay off.
It's great for your longevity, you know, all those proteins that you get to ingest.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Prince also looked remarkably young for his age, so did David Bowie. So maybe they shared the secret of the Queen. Who knows? Because I told you before, I suspect that Prince was literally royalty. And I think David Bowie is probably the bastard of child of some, you know, Sox Coburn wing. Remember, he went to, well, you don't remember, but he at the peak of his fame, he left and went to Berlin for a couple of years, right? To study and to retrain himself. I think that's where they being the Bavarians, the Illuminists, I think that's when they really got to David Bowie and said, okay, you're going to work for us now. Anyway, that's a sidebar. Who does Trump work for? I think he works for Wall Street. He works for the bankers. But it's really a question of whether these Wall Street interests see that the destruction of the United States of America is going to be worth it to them. Right? Do they really want to take us that far down the pit, the abyss?
They need
they
us to.
They can't all evacuate the country.
Well, they actually need us to, because with the pump and dump economic system, you extract resources. And when people don't have any resources, they usually wind up losing their freedoms as well, because they've got nothing to defend those freedoms with, whether that be able to pay for education or a home to live in or a shotgun to defend yourself from a bunch of bloodthirsty bureaucrats from the local city council, you know, that kind of thing. And the problem is we all live in a controlled system. Okay, you know, it's orderly. But in order to make it more tyrannical, you need to make it more chaotic so that people will give up a certain sense of their order. So the plan is essentially to just keep endlessly collapsing the economies until there's less and less and less and less to everybody, to the point of desperation. And then they can go, look, everybody, we're just going to have to propose a solution that we just came up with. You know, we only just came up with it, bro. You know, it hasn't been in the pipeline for like 100 years or anything like that. But everybody's going to get a little microchip and what have you. And it's just going to make your life a lot easier. And people aren't going to go missing. It's going to be real safe, et cetera, et cetera. And as soon as you can make people afraid for a long period of time, it starts to shut down frontal lobe higher thinking activity. They're unable to think clearly, and often they will be in a subset of fight or flight response, which means go to the nearest available safety, and the bankers will only be too happy to offer that safety. Daryl?
Yes, sir.
It's been wonderful, my friend. Do you have a website that you might want to share with our listeners?
Yes, my Facebook page is Professor Hamamoto, and I have a YouTube channel also called Professor Hamamoto. Please check in on this. I post regularly, comment. I have some interesting, as I mentioned earlier, information or insights or hypotheses on Prince. I think he's one of the greatest musicians of our times, maybe even going back at least 100 years or more. And his legacy remains to be seen, of course, but I think he's left a lasting impression.
Thank you very much, Daryl Hamamoto, ladies and gentlemen. You've been listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, listener-supported, financed by you, not Wall Street. We'll see you again sometime, folks. Thanks for listening.